Hello and welcome to the magazine rack. I'm Chris. I'm Mario Cajar, and today I'll be reading from the April 2024 issue of Sports Illustrated magazine and from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. First up, we have an article by Stephen Douglas titled, From DJ Burns to Dayton's Comeback, the Best Moments of the NCAA Tournament So Far. The Final Four of the NCAA 2024 Men's Tournament is set. Number 11 seed North Carolina State is the Cinderella story of the year. Purdue, along with Zach Edey, has answered just about every question the college basketball world asked of them after last year's upset loss. UConn looks like an unstoppable force, steamrolling everything in its path as the Huskies embark on the final stages of their title defense. And Alabama has outlasted everyone so far and doesn't seem poised to let up. The final set of games should be excellent entertainment for audiences everywhere, but this year's tournament has already given us plenty of amazing moments from equally amazing players. What better time to revisit them than leading into the final 2 days of the college basketball season? First is DJ Burns Jr. Every year during March Madness, we're introduced to a number of unique players. This year, none of them captured the imagination the way North Carolina State's DJ Burns Jr. did. The skilled big man was like Nikola Jokic in Big Baby Davis's body. No one had more fun, or was more fun to watch. For many people, the highlight of the NCAA tournament every year is the elimination of the Duke Blue Devils, and Burns was the main character in that story this time around. He scored 29 points and never stopped smiling. Burns flexed and grinned and dominated as the Wolfpack returned to the Final Four for the first time since 1983. Next is Jack Gaulke. The breakout star of the first round was Jack Gaulke. The former Division II player came off the bench to make an absurd 10 of 20 three-pointers on his way to a 32-point performance in an upset win over the Kentucky Wildcats. He cooled down a little in the second round, making just 6 of 17 attempts from beyond the arc and a loss to NC State. But that opening round performance is the reason the tournament is so great. Not only did Gaulke blow up long enough to film a TurboTax ad in his hotel between games, he also helped shine a brighter light on his coach, Greg Campy, the longest-tenured college basketball coach in America. It was a great moment for the tournament and an even better moment for Oakland University, which everyone now knows is in Michigan. Colorado 102, Florida 100. The Colorado Buffaloes took down the Florida Gators in the first round in what was one of the highest scoring games in tournament history. A number 10 seed beating a number 7 seed isn't a huge upset, but who cares when you see that many points with the last basket coming with just 2 seconds remaining on the clock. KJ Simpson gave Colorado a 7-point lead with 1:26 remaining, but Florida roared back to tie the game with 11 seconds to go. And that's when Simpson stepped up and hit the game winner from the baseline to give the Buffaloes just their fourth NCAA tournament win of the 21st century. Next is Dayton's comeback. The Nevada Wolfpack took a 56-39 lead over the Dayton Flyers with 7:36 remaining in their first round matchup. Dayton went on to outscore Nevada 24-4 over the final minutes of the game. It's the kind of chaos the tournament encourages. Neither of the teams were meant for a deep run, but they still provided fans with an incredible viewing experience. And let's face it, that's the most important part of March. Creighton outlasts Oregon. The Blue Jays beat the Ducks 86-73 during the second round of the tournament, and the final score doesn't come close to telling the whole story. The biggest lead of the second half was 6 points by Oregon. Both teams traded baskets in the final seconds with a Baylor Shireman jumper followed by a missed Oregon layup to send the game into overtime. The teams continued to go back and forth into a second extra period. Eventually, Oregon stalled in double overtime, but for 45 minutes, this was one of the tightest games you're ever going to see. Now, Bama knocks out UNC. Alabama hung on to beat North Carolina 89-87 in the Sweet 16 on their way to the first Final Four berth in school history. In the process, the Crimson Tide became the first team to knock out a number one seed this March. North Carolina had the lead at halftime, but Alabama had just enough in the second half to pull off the upset behind a balanced attack, with four starters scoring 18 points or more. Mustachioed senior Grant Nelson led the way with 24 points, 12 rebounds, and 5 blocks. Now, Yale upsets Auburn. After Oakland, Yale pulled off the second biggest upset of the first round as the number 13 seed from the Ivy League took down one of the top teams from the SEC, 78-76. Junior guard John Poulakidas had a breakout game, scoring a season-high 28 points on 10 of 15 shooting, including 6 of 9 from behind the arc. As for Auburn, it was a brutal loss. The Tigers had a lead at halftime and then could not score in the final seconds, missing 3 free throws and 2 more field goals during a mad scramble as time ran out. Now, Texas A&M forces overtime against Houston. The Houston Cougars won their first round game easily, but needed overtime to get past number 9 seed Texas A&M 2 days later. Houston blew a 10-point lead with 4:26 remaining, setting the stage for Anderson Garcia to hit one of the biggest shots of the tournament. Texas A&M took the ball out underneath its own basket with 1.2 seconds remaining, and Garcia fielded a bounce pass at the top of the key before letting it fly. As he fell to the ground, the ball went through the hoop to tie the game and force overtime. Houston would end up being too much for the Aggies in the extra period, but Garcia's shot will live on forever as one of the moments that makes March so great. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Up next, we have another NCAA article. This one's by Ryan Phillips, special to SI.com, and it's titled, Iowa's Elite Eight win over LSU broke ratings records. Caitlin Clark and Iowa keep breaking viewership records. According to ESPN, the Hawkeyes' Elite Eight win over LSU from Monday night drew 12.3 million viewers. That makes it the most watched women's college basketball game on record and the most watched college basketball game ever on ESPN platforms. The rematch of the 2023 National Championship lived up to the hype. The news comes after it was announced the Sweet 16 of the 2024 NCAA Women's Tournament was the most watched in history. Iowa's win over Colorado drew 6.9 million viewers, while LSA versus UCLA had 3.8 million watching. South Carolina's win over Indiana garnered 2.1 million viewers. And UConn's victory against Duke drew 2 million. To put the Iowa versus LSU numbers in perspective, the 2023 NBA Finals only averaged 11.64 million viewers. Clark's rematch against Angel Reese, Kim Mulkey, and LSU cleared that mark. Those ratings are also higher than the 2023 World Series, which checked in at 9.11 million viewers. Those who tuned in got one heck of a show. Iowa's 94-87 victory was a fast-paced, high-scoring affair, and those stars kept shining. Clark scored 41 points, dished out 12 assists, and grabbed 7 rebounds while hitting 9 three-pointers. For LSU, Reese finished with 17 points, 20 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 blocks, and 2 steals. Flaujay Johnson had 23 points, 6 rebounds, and 3 blocks. Clark and Iowa have now reached the Final Four once again and will face UConn, who topped USC in the Elite Eight. As The Athletic's Nicole Arbach noted, that contest drew 6.7 million viewers, which would have been the most for a non-Final Four women's game ever, if not for all the records broken this year. Additionally, UConn's women's team garnered more viewership than the UConn men's Elite Eight game did, at 6.48 million viewers. Iowa and UConn's Final Four matchup should be another ratings monster for ESPN as women's basketball continues breaking viewership records. This is the Magazine Rack on Chris. Up next is an article by Brian Jufra, special to SI.com, titled, "It's Premature to Compare Scottie Scheffler to Tiger Woods." Ever since he won the Players' Championship 2 weeks ago for his second consecutive tour win, Scottie Scheffler has been compared to Tiger Woods by virtually every major golf media outlet around. It's fair, it's normal, it's exciting, and it's also premature. Scheffler, while on a torrid stretch of immaculate golf to start the 2024 season, is still not in the stratosphere of Woods' best season. In fact, you could argue he's not even close to being as good as Tiger was in his fifth best season, or maybe even more. Now, that's not taking shots at Scheffler. It's a statistical fact. According to datagolf.com, Scheffler is currently averaging 3.3 true strokes gained in 2024, which is a measure of the number of strokes you beat the field by in a given round. That's 0.75 strokes gained better than the next person on this year's list, Xander Schofield, but still would be worse than Tiger's fourth best season measured using this statistic. From 2006 to 2009, Tiger had a better true strokes gained number than Scheffler. Unfortunately, this stat only goes back to 2004, but it seems likely that Tiger would have had a better number than Scheffler from 1999 to 2002 as well. He won seven majors and had 28 total wins in that stretch. This season, Scheffler has won the Arnold Palmer Invitational and the Players' Championship, two historically top-tier events. Those events are still missing several of the top players in the world because of the LIV PGA Tour fiasco. Opening that can of worms isn't important in this conversation, however. What is important is reminding everyone we're still too early in the year to compare Scheffler to Woods. And yet that's what's happened since the Players. Outlets are comparing them because Scheffler's odds to win this week's Houston Open are as low as Woods used to be, and because Scheffler is currently fourth on Data Golf's all-time strokes gained per round ranking, a full stroke plus behind Woods at number one. Tiger won two majors in a season three times, won four out of eight majors twice in his career, and at one point won five out of six majors. He won 10 tournaments in a season once, 9 tournaments twice, and 7 tournaments three times. This means Scheffler would need to win 5 more times this season just to match something Tiger did 3 times. And that doesn't include the majors Tiger won those seasons. If Scheffler continues to win and claims a major or two, we can start comparing his current run to Woods. Until then, it's premature. You're in tune with the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now we have an article by Stephanie Apstein titled, "Twilight Zone." Spare a thought for poor Regan Bregman, who sometimes finds herself telling a story to no one. She thinks her husband, Alex, is listening, and then she glances over and realizes he only has eyes for his iPhone, on which he's watching videos of his swing. When their 18-month-old son, Knox, sees the device come out, he says, "Baseball bat!" He thinks that's the only thing the phone does. Bregman's teammates are used to this behavior. Every time he has a spare minute, and often when he doesn't, he calls up video and loses himself in it. During batting practice, when teammates are chattering, he's glued to footage of his most recent swings. "You can talk to him," says right fielder Kyle Tucker, "but he won't hear you." "I'm like obsessed with it," Bregman says now. "I never get tired of it." In high school, he sometimes hit for so long that he would fall asleep in the batting cage. Occasionally, the coaches would send him home. 20 minutes later, he'd be back. "I went home," he'd say. In college, the LSU student managers got so many 11 p.m. calls requesting they open the facility that they issued him his own key card. His Astros teammates laugh when they walk into the clubhouse at noon for a 7 p.m. game and see their third baseman sitting in his locker in full uniform. Hitting coach Troy Snitker rolls his eyes, but complies when Bregman insists on finding a facility in road cities where he can get in a few extra hacks. How many swings does he take per day? Mental reps? Thousands, says Tucker. Actual reps? Probably thousands, too. Every day this winter, Bregman woke up around 7 a.m. and ate breakfast and played with Knox. An hour later, they drove to Exos, a gym in Phoenix, to meet Reagan, who was exercising there. Alex handed Knox off to her and got to work. An hour of agility and speed work on the turf, a two-hour upper body lift on Mondays and Thursdays, and a two-hour lower body lift on Tuesdays and Fridays. Wednesdays were recovery days when he worked on his breathing and did mobility exercises. In the afternoon, he spent 2 or 3 hours in the cage at JP3, a baseball facility half an hour southeast of Phoenix, working through a routine that included using under- and overweighted bats to improve his bat speed. Then, more mobility exercises, and then, of course, video. Go to dinner and do it all over again, says Snitker. Even for a baseball rat, that's a lot of time in the maze. But in many ways, 2024 could be the most important year of Bregman's career, and he wants to be ready for it. He'll be 30 in March, and he can become a free agent after the season. It would be his last chance to win another World Series with the only team he's ever known. This year could shape his future and reshape the way people view his past. Bregman scoffs at the question, did he watch last year's World Series? Until 4 days before it began, he expected to play in it. Houston made it to the ALCS for the 7th straight year, a run of dominance unprecedented in the modern era. Against their divisional rival Rangers, the Astros lost after taking a 3-2 series lead. Bregman homered in Game 7, but it didn't matter. His disappointment felt more like grief. And yet, 4 days later, there he was at 7:03 p.m. Central, locked on the TV. Every pitch, he says. He watched his friend and 2010 Team USA U-16 teammate Corey Seager demolish a ninth-inning fastball for Texas to key a Game 1 comeback en route to the title. I wish that was us, says Bregman. But if I'm wishing that, well, we should have played better. They usually do. By now, the Astros chuckle at the annual question, how can this team possibly be so consistently successful? Their owner, Jim Crane, is committed to winning. Their front office, on its third general manager of the dynasty after the initial architect, Jeff Luno, lost his job in the wake of the 2017 sign-stealing scandal, and the second one, James Click, was ousted after the 22 season because he butted heads with Crane, makes good decisions. The coaching staff emphasizes the details. The players like one another. But a lot of other teams have committed owners and smart front offices and detail-oriented coaches and good team chemistry. None of them have made 7 straight championship series. We execute, says Bregman. We didn't execute at a high enough level last year in all phases of the game. Everyone in the big leagues is super talented. I feel like the guys in this room are just baseball players that know how to win games and know what it takes. Being able to execute an approach, execute a game plan, catch the ball on defense, get a leadoff guy out in the big inning, not making base-running mistakes, just play clean baseball. It sounds simple, and maybe it is when you have good players. Their dominance also begets dominance. They have played in October so many times that they're comfortable under the brightest lights, and they weathered enough vitriol from fans in the wake of the revelation that they stole signs illegally en route to their 2017 championship that no jeers from the bleachers can compare to the death threats that their wives received on social media. For a while, it was easy to attribute their success to Lunau's tank and rebuild strategy. But the Astros have not chosen higher than number 20 in the draft since 2017, and they forfeited their first and second round picks in 20 and 21 as punishment for the scandal. Then it was easy to point to the illegal camera feed they watched near the dugout to swipe the opposing catcher's signs and the trash can they banged on to tell the hitter what was coming. But it's been 6 years since the league installed security guards to monitor teams' use of video. Houston has played in three World Series since then, winning in 2022. Privately, current and former Astros sometimes wonder how many World Series they would have to win before fans, opponents, and reporters stop suggesting that they stole the 2017 title. The answer is obviously not two. They also point out, and correctly, that only four members of that 2017 team remain: Bregman, second baseman Jose Altuve, and two pitchers, Lance McCullers Jr. and Justin Verlander. Yet right-hander Hunter Brown, who was a sophomore at Wayne State during that World Series, and catcher Yanier Diaz, who was an 18-year-old playing for Cleveland's Dominican Summer League team that year, will hear boos all season. That tainted season is part of this group's story, even as the members of the group change. In some ways, they are victims of their own success. If Crane had torn down the organization after the scandal and started from scratch, enduring another 5 years of losing, no one would wonder whether there was anything nefarious behind any future winning seasons. But because the Astros stayed good, fans stayed mad. Bregman says he doesn't think how another World Series in what could be his last season in Houston might affect his or the team's legacy. All he will say is, and I quote, "I want to win this year more than anything in the world," end quote. Over the years, Houston has allowed talent to depart. Right-handers Charlie Morton in 2019 and Jarrett Cole in 2020, center fielder George Springer in 21, shortstop Carlos Correa in 22. All were all-stars, but they staggered their departures. The one thing you don't want to see in an organization is all of a sudden most of your guys become free agents simultaneously, and then the organization falls off a cliff, says second-year GM Dana Brown. When that happens, that's very difficult. You got to rebuild, and so you have to be relentless at thinking about making trades to maybe fill up a rotation spot that may be coming up. And you can't just be caught off guard. And I think that's the big part of why we've been successful here. Brown made moves to avoid that cliff this offseason. He signed Padres closer Josh Hader for 5 years and $95 million, giving the Astros arguably the best bullpen in baseball and providing insurance if incumbent closer Ryan Pressly hits free agency after this season. Houston also re-signed Altuve for 5 years and $125 million, a deal which will take him through his age 39 season. Jim Crane is very adamant about this. "The window is always open," says Brown. "We don't see windows of opportunity. We just think the window's always open. I think our team is really good, and I think we're going to be good this year. I think we're going to be good next year. And I think we're going to be good the year after that." After Morton and Cole left, homegrown lefty Framber Valdez became an all-star last year. Springer's departure rearranged the outfield and made room for Tucker, who finished fifth in AL MVP voting last season. And Jeremy Peña, Correa's replacement at shortstop, was the World Series MVP in 2022. The Astros currently have no obvious backup for Bregman. At some point, do you remove enough pieces so that the whole thing collapses? "I really hope he finishes his career here," says Altuve, himself an 8-time All-Star. "He's one of the best players, not only right now, but in Astros history. He's a franchise player, so I really hope that we make something happen for him so that he can stay for a long time." This winter, Bregman made a request of his family and friends. he did not want to talk about his free agency at all this season. But that won't stop the rest of us. Since 2017, his first full season, Bregman has been the 10th most valuable player in baseball, according to Baseball Reference. He will clearly be the second most valuable player on the market next season after Yankees left fielder Juan Soto, who will be 26. They share a representative, Scott Boras, who tends to be better at separating owners from their money than anyone else in the industry. Entering his age 31 season, Bregman will be 1 year older than Manny Machado was when he signed his 11-year, $350 million extension with the Padres last year, and the same age Aaron Judge was when he signed his 9-year, $360 million free agent deal with the Yankees before last season. Among Boras's strategies is a willingness to hold out for the best deal. And indeed, his top five clients this year remained unsigned as camps opened, working out instead at Boras facilities. That arrangement would seem an imperfect fix for a baseball rat like Bregman, but he might not have to wait so long. Big spenders, including the Cubs, Dodgers, Yankees, Mets, Giants, and Blue Jays, should all be interested in him. Their primary question will be about his legs. After he finished 2 first-place votes shy of winning the AL MVP award in 2019, Bregman missed 3 weeks in 2020 with a strained right hamstring and more than 2 months in 2021 with a strained left quadriceps. This was his first off-season in 3 years, he says, in which he could focus on getting better rather than just getting healthy. The physical problems become mental at points. Movements that had once come naturally now seemed impossible to replicate. He used to think about his hands, and his legs would do what they were supposed to do. Suddenly, though, he can no longer rely on his body to put itself into the right positions. Midway through 2022, as Bregman's OPS dropped to .694, Snitker sat Bregman down and explained that he needed to start thinking about hitting differently. Whether Bregman knew it or not, his legs had been the key to his swing. Only when they were firing correctly did his hands fall into place. "You were doing these things," said Snitker. "You didn't know you were doing them." They began to focus on his lower half. From July on, Bregman had an .864 OPS. During that postseason title run, that number was .948. Bregman took Snitker's advice to heart. "This winter, I was like, I'm going to start thinking about it a lot different than I had in the past," says Bregman. "I sat down with Snit, and it was like, talk to me about your understanding of the swing. I'm not going to bring any of my biases into the equation. I want to understand what I was doing that I didn't know I was doing." And we started talking about different ways of talking about it, and how I load into my rear hip and why that was so important. They watched drill work from 2018 and then went through each subsequent year. "I know, because we keep track of what my mental cues are, how I thought I was actually swinging and moving, and what I thought was important in a swing and what wasn't," says Bregman. "And then we talked about why that kind of put me in different positions at the plate than I had been in the past, and started focusing on loading into my back hip again like 2018, and not worrying about my hands at all, which used to be my only cue. And it was weird, because as soon as I started doing that, my hands cleaned up exactly how I wanted them to." He incorporated those ideas into his workout regimen, focusing more on rotation than he ever has before. J.P. Sportman, against whom Bregman played in the minors, recalls Bregman frequently mentioned wanting to win the World Series. Every so often, minor leaguers would visit Sportman's facility while Bregman was hitting. And during one of those sessions, in what seemed to the minor leaguers to be a break, one of the kids asked Bregman a question. He got no answer. Bregman couldn't hear him. He was thinking about 2024. And that'll do it for this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the April 2024 issue of Sports Illustrated Magazine, and from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. I'm Mario Cahar. So long till next time.